History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to take some action, ask some questions, invest some time in listening. The point is, we want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And what happens along the way is that we're always educated, we're always entertained, and inevitably we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The week behind us was a week of remembrance in so many ways. We've heard a lot of World War II veterans share on this program how December 7th, 1941 changed the world, and almost every one of them over the years has been able to share a specific memory of where he was when he found out about Pearl Harbor. Almost 60 years later, September 11th, 2001 became a similarly shocking day, leaving its own imprint on all of us who are alive for it. I hope you had the chance to participate in remembrance ceremonies where you lived this last week. And we're going to actually hear from someone with a powerful 9/11 story in the weeks ahead. But one thing that struck me this week was how, despite how often we emphasize never forget, as committed as so many organizations are to make sure the lessons of 9/11 don't slip away, the volume of coverage for the 25th anniversary brought back to the surface some details and angles on what took place in our country that day and the days that followed that I have to admit I had actually forgotten about. It's good to be reminded, isn't it? And now that we've reached the point that none of today's school children were alive when it happened, each of us has an even greater obligation to tell those stories. Amidst all the deserving attention on the 9/11 anniversary this last week was one story you might have missed, unless you happen to be in Bakersfield, California, where the Kern County Sheriff's Department and California Highway Patrol made an arrest of someone going 105. No, not on the freeway, but in a retirement facility. They jokingly arrested Ron Holdsworth and told him it's against the law to turn 105. It definitely doesn't happen too often. And if you did happen to see Ron's smiling face on television or social media, maybe you'd like to hear a little more of his story. We focused on American veterans of World War II on this program all these years, but this World War II veteran wasn't wearing a U.S. uniform, but that of the Royal Air Force. And here's what he remembers about his early years in jolly old England.
Yeah, well, there was my mother and father, and I had six sisters and a brother that ranged from the difference in the ages. The oldest one, Stan, was born in 1915, and the youngest girl was born in 1927. There was eight children. My brother was the oldest, and I was fourth position.
And I've talked to a lot of Americans about your age, and they went through that Great Depression here in the States, and having a lot of mouths to feed was a big challenge.
Oh, yeah, well, it was with us, you know, and eight children, and my father worked on the public transport. Eight children is a lot to feed, and he was a very friendly guy with the people on the buses and streetcars and whatever. He used to get to know people that were in a position to help and whatever and give you stuff and whatnot, you know. And I know as we got older, we all had to take our turn. And here, go to this place, I tell you, my dad said, give you different things. It was either food or clothing or stuff like that.
And I know it's a long time ago, but do you remember as a boy there in England having an idea, a dream, hey, when I grow up, this is what I want to do with my life, or this is who I want to be?
I didn't know what I wanted to be, because when I was a youngster, I don't know how old I was at the time, something happened to my right leg, and it kind of pulled up, they had me in bed at home for quite some time, and then they said they'd have to take me to the hospital, so they took me to the hospital. And I can't remember exactly. I think I was in there about 3 months.
Wow.
I was So it made an awful lot of difference to my schooling and my, you know, I missed a lot of things. But they had my leg up like this and like a pin on it and on a pulley, and every so often they'd put things that weights on to, you know, they kind of put down, and it was in the joint here or something. And anyway, eventually, they had this big sticking plaster all over my leg. One day, the nurse came up to me and she said, Ron, we're going to give you a bath. You know, I said, well, that sounds good. She said, but before we give you the bath, we're going to take all that plaster off your leg. Well, imagine it's pulling that plaster off the leg.
A little painful?
Oh, man. And then they took me to the... and gave me a bath. That was felt good, you know. And then they... I forget what they did then or something. But as I know, they started walking around the ward a bit and then a bit more, and then it got that I could kind of walk fairly good. And so the day came when they let me go. My dad was working. My mother couldn't come because she had the little one. So my older brother, he and his friend came and picked me up from the hospital and carried me on their shoulders, you know, to go to the bus stop. Then we got on the bus, and the bus passed the end of our street and stopped, and I just had to carry me up the street to back home and that. And then after time, it was fine.
Well, I was going to say, they must have done a good job, because you're still walking at 103. There's not too many people who can say that.
They're a fashion, yeah.
You know, I was thinking, with the American vets, they all have a clear memory of when America got pulled into the war after Pearl Harbor. But for someone who grew up in England, what was the moment when you knew you were at war?
Let's see, the war broke out in 1939, in September 1939, you know what caused the Second World War? The German troops dressed up in Polish uniforms and attacked Poland and said it was their fault, and that gave them an excuse to start. Anyway, the war started in September, and I was 18 in September. Germany did the bit on the 1st of September, and France and Germany declared war on the 3rd of September. And then on the 13th of September, I was 18. And I was working for what you call a paper and twine merchant. I ran the warehouse. Anyway, yeah, the war broke out. And I thought to myself, on my birthday, I said, now I'm 18. I guess I'll be going into service, you know, when they call me up, because 18 is about when they start to grab you. I was thinking of going to volunteer for the Navy, but then someone told me, you can't sign up for just certain years. You have to sign up for a certain period of time. Well, that's a long time. And I'm, what happens if I don't like it, you know? So I didn't do that, naturally. So I waited a little bit longer, and then I went and volunteered for the Air Force, where I did all the paperwork and then the physical and etc. And then you go back home and wait until you're called. But I did this on my own. I didn't tell my mother and father. My mother had a fit. I told her everything, you know, and I'd volunteered, you know. So anyway, the time came and the paper came and told us to report to the office, and they took us and put us on the train, and we got to the camp where we were supposed to report. We were only there a day because they were so crowded. They couldn't cope with everybody. So we were there just long enough to get our number. They sent us back home. That was in February. I think it was April when we got recalled. And then we were in the Air Force then. We were there just long enough to give us a meal, and they marched us out of the camp and up the road a piece and then a bit more to the local railroad station. We got on the train, and we didn't go travel too far. And when we got out, we found we were at a place called Blackpool. It's a holiday town. That's where we ended up. And they got us all lined up and marched us from where the train station was to the promenade, partway down the promenade, and then started drifting off on these streets and avenues. And they'd stop every so often at a boarding house or a private hotel, and they'd read so-and-so's name. And this is where you're going to be staying for 6 weeks. Three of us were detailed to this boarding house. It was very nice. We got the same food as the people that pay to stay there for their week's holiday or whatever. It would have been better than the food in the camp anyway. So we were there for 6 weeks. Every morning about 8 o'clock, I think it was, we'd have to be outside in the street and other guys coming out the other places, you know, until we were all outside. And they'd march you off to do whatever they were going to do that day. If it was jumping up and down or running or marching, we did a lot of drilling and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, we finished our training at that place. We were told to get our gear all packed and the next morning be outside at such and such a time with your gear. They would call out so many names. You guys are going to so-and-so place. And I think there was 8 of us. We were sent to a place called Dishforth. That's a bomber station. It was a bomber station then, with the early bombers of Whitley, the Whitley bomber. So we were sent there to do this and that and anything they could find you to do. Swamp the floors or whatever, you know, be on guard duty. And I said, I don't fancy this, you know. So they said I couldn't get into aircrew. So I signed up to go on a mechanics course. They sent me off and I graduated from the flight school. I think around about Christmas time. And I was back at home. And I got this notification to report to RAF station just outside London. I was at this RAF station. That's when they told me they didn't have sleeping quarters there. Everybody was billeted out. So they took me to a place not too far from the camp so that I could walk and talk to the people there. It was just a young couple with a little tot. They said they were going to billet me onto them. They said, okay, they'll show me their room where I was going to stay. And they had this little tot, you know. It followed me all over the place. Anyway, I had to get up in the morning and I could go to the mess hall. They had a mess hall when I got there. But these couple always insisted I have something to eat that before I leave. They were so nice. Anyway, I left there and went to where I was supposed to be, and it was hurricanes. We worked on hurricanes, you know. Heck, I wasn't there 2 minutes. I was only there about a couple of months or something like that. I got no idea, not long, because I was sent back home. But I wasn't at home all that long. Then I had to report to another transit camp. We left Liverpool sometime in April and we went out into the Atlantic and joined the convoy. There's all kind of rumours going on where we were going and where you can't. Say, well, you've got your tropical outfit, you know, says, oh, you're going where it's warm, you know. But anyway, we were in cabins, which is unusual. During the night, there was such a bump. And of course, the story that I tell you, oh, we've been torpedoed, you know. And then the siren went off and told a report to the boat stations and all that. And after we stood at the boat station for a while, we were told to return to our cabins. It turned out that it wasn't torpedoed, you know, it's a lot of our ship and another ship collided. We don't know what caused it or anything, but I don't know whether you know or not, but ships at sea at dark, when they, especially in convoys, if they're going to turn or whatever, there's a, you know, it's he'd eat for one way and the port and work for the other way. Anyway, they fixed us up in West Africa there. Off we sailed down and round the Cape. I think one or two ships left us for Cape Town. I don't know where the most of them went, but we ended up at Durban, which is round the corner from Cape Town.
That is a long way from Bakersfield, California, where the community celebrated Ron Holdsworth's 105th birthday this week. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we're going to hear about his closest call in the air during World War II. He survived 32 missions in Halifax bombers with the Royal Air Force, and he's still going. So will we. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, celebrating one of the oldest World War II veterans in America, whose uniform happened to be that of Great Britain. Ron Holdsworth is marking birthday number 105, but if you want to talk about time, he was wearing the Royal Air Force uniform in World War II for longer than the entire time America was actually engaged in that war. Before he started flying in British warplanes, he was fixing them and maintaining them. And when we left off, he had made it to Durban, South Africa.
When we got off the ship, they put us on a train, and it was only just outside the town of Durban. And we were there for 2 weeks. It was nice there, a nice time. We could go into Durban, and of course we didn't have a lot of money in those days, you know. And any times you didn't get paid, we met some nice frat people, you know, some nice girls who were dancing and whatever. Then the time for us came for us to go. They took us to the docks again, and when we saw the ship we were going on, I thought, oh my God, it wasn't at all like the other one. And most of us slept on the deck all the way up the side of East Africa, you know. We ended up through the canal, I forget the name, that Ismailia, I think it was. And now we were there for close to 3 months, just doing nothing, just sleeping in tents, and we didn't do anything. And then they came and told us we were moving, so we got on put us on another crappy old ship and took us down to Mombasa. We got off the boat and with them, we boarded the train. It was late at night and the train had wood seats, and we travelled about 100 miles from there to Nairobi. And then we travelled another 100 miles to Nakuru. And Nakuru was about 600 and some feet higher up than the lowlands, and it was a little more tolerable, a bit more cooler. Well, anyway, that was a train station for Blenheims, you know, three-member crew, and we were the mechanics of various trades, worked on them, doing this and that and the other. I was a flight mechanic, airframe. Well, I was there for... We arrived there in September. The following May, I and some of the guys, we were transferred to the maintenance unit in Nairobi, about 6 months. And then one day, the engineering officer came over and said, pack your gear. And I said, where am I going now? He said, you're going to Madagascar. Oh, boy. So I was going by myself on the train back to Mombasa in a crappy old boat. Well, it went to two or three places before it came back to Madagascar, you know, and I dropped off there just before Christmas. So I spent Christmas on Madagascar. We were on the peninsula and the mainland across the bay. I think there was 24 of us on the peninsula, and we had two Lysanders. I seemed to be the only guy that was doing anything, you know. They moved us eventually onto the mainland. And one morning, the clerk came to me and he said, Ron, pack your gear. I said, what for? I said, she said, you're going back to Nairobi. I said, what's the reason? He says, your aircrew train's come through. So they flew me back on a Sunderland flying boat. Before I went, the guy said, but you can't take your stuff with you because of the weight on the, you know, you're only allowed so much. And that. He said, all you can take is a change of underwear, your toiletries, and that. And that's it. We'll forward the other stuff on to you. Well, you know, I never saw it again. I had all kinds of stuff that I collected. Never saw it again, because I guess each place I went to from there, somebody'd have a little double out of it. But anyway, I was in Nairobi for a couple of weeks, I think it was, somewhere around there. And they gave me a few tests, and then they said, get your gear together. And I think there was three of us. We were back up to Nakuru again. And then past Nakuru, they put us on the lake steamer, and we went down to the south of the lake. Put us on a train. But we finally ended up in Tanganyika. We were just right about on the border of the Belgian Congo. And we got on some boats and we travelled through, partly through a jungle in a truck. All I forgot to tell you, with us were three South African officers and three South African WAF girls, you know. And they were travelling with us, you know, on the trains and everything else. And they were on the trucks with us when we went through the jungle and all that. There was like missionaries there, and they had a nice building and that. And we took us all in there. We all had showers and they fed us. And the time came for us to go, and we went on another train and finally ended up in Bulawayo. Anyway, after it all settled down, they took us to this RAF camp, and it was mostly training. We did a lot, but some math too, quite a bit of math. Mostly we learned the Morse code and some of the bits and pieces. And then they moved us from, it was called Hillside. They moved us from there to the place where we did a lot of training. It was called Gwello. And we did this and that, and, you know, one little bit of this, and then we started flying with the navigators, you know, companions and whatever, you know. When all that was done and we had done all our gunnery stuff and aircraft recognition, when we've done all that and all was finished, then we got our stripes. Because we'd been over, well, most of us have been abroad about 3 years then, they were sending us back to England. We had to go from Rhodesia back to South Africa, where we started from, Durban, and wait for a ship to take us home. They took us up as far as Egypt, because then the crew got mad, because they thought they were going to go back to England, you know. But I don't know what happened, but they had to go back somewhere else and left us in Egypt. We had to catch an army troop ship coming from the Far East, which comes through the canal and that. They put us on that one, and that was all army people. And we got this business all the time. You know. Finally, when we got back to Liverpool, it was in the wee hours of the morning, because it was dark. We were told, you know, we get off the ship. As we were walking down the gangplank to the dock, on the next deck above was a bunch of army guys going, drill clean boys. And we were going, you know.
You were returning the salute with a finger, huh?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So because you're getting off the boat first. We got with it. They put us on a train, and we ended up at Harrogate. And we're there for, till they sorted things out. And then from Harrogate, we were sent to a place called Catterick. And we was in this big building, and it was just full of aircrew. Pilots, navigators, bombardiers, radio guys, and gunners. And then we were told, sort your own crews out. Get to know each other and have you make your own crews. So that's what we did. And there were six of us. We were sent up to Lossiemouth in north Scotland. And that's where we trained together on Wellingtons. That was a twin-engine bomber. We did all our training on that, and then you all did your individual training about other things and, you know, gunnery and all. Then the time came for us to... We were going back to Yorkshire to the last part of our training. And then we joined the rest of the guys for training on the Halifax bomber. And that's where we picked up the flight engineer. Then we finished there and we were sent to Lisset in East Yorkshire to the squadron, 158 squadron. And when we got there, the rest of us found out that we didn't have a flight engineer. And it was known then that the pilot wouldn't accept the flight engineer. He said he didn't think he was trained enough. We still went onto the squadron without a flight engineer. So when we started operations, we got a spare flight engineer that was on the squadron because there were spares of all trades over one thing and another. So that's when we started operations. Our first operation was to Brest. Our second was to La Pochenée, which was a flying bomb site. Our third was to Calais, and then the next three was to Le Havre. 3 days in a row to Le Havre. That was all done, and then there were the German targets from then on in. All the different targets we went to, and sometimes you were... You know, other times it wasn't bad. There was one place I thought was kind of hairy. We went 3 days in a row. That really made you twitter, you know, yeah. Because at that time we didn't have our own aircraft. We keep getting a spare aircraft. A crew's having a day off or they're on vacation. You'll be flying in their aircraft until the time came when you got your own. I know this particular time we were flying different planes, you know. Well, same kind of plane, but we have been flying in, I don't know whether it was Y York or something, one of them anyway, and we were doing the bombing run at Gelsenkirchen again, and that was a hot spot, you know, really hot. The flak was coming up, and the plane that we had been in the day before, on the same place, phew, it was way in front of us, you know, on the run end. It got a belly hit or something, you know, and it just... Psh, and then, oh, thank the Lord we weren't in that one, you know.
So the very plane that you had flown the previous mission in went down and those guys were lost.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, that certainly underscores the possibilities of what could happen to you. Maybe you can tell us in general what it's like to be in the tail gun of a Halifax on a bombing mission. What are you watching for? What are you seeing? What are you feeling? What's that duty like?
At night time, you can't see anything, you know, because if there is something, it'll be all of a sudden, you know. Yeah. And to me, they're not going to do that because they're going to hit you or something. And if they hit you, they'd hit too, you know. In my position, for us, all our missions, we completed all right without any things. We might have had an odd dint once, a couple of times, but something you don't really notice. But I never had to bear my guns on anything all the time that I flew.
And that's 32 missions.
But I was there all the time, you know, waiting to nothing. I'd see them. I did see a lot of fighters at night time because that's mostly when we went.
Because the Americans would fly during the day and then you would hit some of those same targets at night?
Yeah. We did some day trips as well, you know, but most of them were at night. I can honestly say I never even saw a fighter. I saw the flak.
Well, that's got to be unnerving too, because isn't that a little helpless when you see the flak coming up?
Oh, well, you can't do anything about it. No, no. I've seen all the planes go down, you know, because it's just a long run, and especially in the rear turret. You're on your own. There's nobody there. Up front, there's the pilot, the navigator, the bombardier, or bomber, as we call them, and the flight engineer. There's four of them up front. They can see each other all the time. And then behind them, sitting on, is a radio operator. So that's five of them, because the middle of the gun has a, and he can see them. And the rear gun is on his own. He's on his toddy. He can't see anybody. It's, I wouldn't say it was nerve-wracking. It's just irksome at times, you know. What are you going to do, you know? You sit there all the time. Fortunately, I never had to use my guns on an operation.
But the enemy was using guns against you, and there's proof of that on your wall. It's a picture I first saw in our friend Arnold Martinez's book, Never Forget. He put that in there too. That's from Christmas Eve, 1944. What happened that day?
Oh, we were scheduled for a flight to a German airfield. It was in the industrial rural area, you know. Something like that. They had this fighter airfield, which was a very, very annoying, you know. And so they sent us, it was Christmas Eve day, yeah. We just ran along in daylight, and we were, you have three leaders, you have the point and the starboard and the port, you know, three of you. We were starboard leader, and just before we got up to the target is when we got hit, and it shook the aircraft, and I thought, what the hell's happened now, you know, because me being at back, he can't say anything or anything, you know. And then, of course, the plane wobbled and that, and then I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to be a guest of adults for Christmas.
There's a photo of Ron's plane on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and if you take the time to look at it, you'll probably wonder how he didn't end up as a prisoner of war, or even worse. But here he is at 105. So we've got to hear the rest of that story, and we will when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the chance to celebrate birthday number 105 for Ron Holdsworth. If you haven't seen how Bakersfield, California celebrated that occasion this week yet, pull up the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. In addition to that, you'll find a photo of the Royal Air Force Halifax bomber he was in on Christmas Eve, 1944. And when we left off, we heard Ron quip that when an enemy round struck that plane, he thought he was going to be a guest of Adolf's for Christmas.
But anyway, I thought, well, I better keep put until the skipper says anything, you know. We still kept flying, it was going on, so I thought, being at the back and not seeing anything, you know, it's awkward. Everybody else in the plane can see or hear what's going on. But you can't until whatever happens, if you get out of it and all that, they can come and tell you. After a little period of time, I think it was the skipper that called me on the intercom and told me what had happened. But he said, we're all right, we're flying all right. We're still going to the target. So we went on and bomb him and did his thing. We were all right coming back, but we didn't land on our station, a place called Carnaby. It was an emergency landing strip on the coast. We landed on that.
Because of the damage, and I think I read that, didn't you guys have to lower your altitude so you could breathe?
Yeah, well, that was the skipper's job, you know, whatever that goes on up front. Me being at the back, I don't know what the hell's going on. So that's what happened. We landed at Carnaby because he wanted to make sure that it was okay. So they landed all right, and then it was dark, so we couldn't see exactly what had happened. I think some transport came from our station, because it's not that far from our squadron. So we went back, and everybody thought we were heroes, you know, good show and all that kind of stuff. When he got back, we had to go through inspection and all that first, you know, where you have to give your report. Whatever they're doing, whatever the radio or the pilot or whatever, you have to give a report. And you'll get your toddy, a shot of whiskey or rum or something, you know. But then you can go to the dining room and scoff up and whatever. Then you go and have your beers and whatever, and if you have a WAF friend on the station, she'd be there as well, you know. Thank the Lord, you know, and all that kind of thing. Go back and get sleep. And then the next day, the skipper got I think it was four standing, plus the guy, I think it was a navigator taking the picture. Uh-huh. Yeah, and he took that picture that's there.
And that picture shows a big gaping hole in the side of the fuselage, and... Uh-huh. What's your understanding of what caused all that damage?
What we were told is we were hit by, they don't know for sure whether it was an exploding shell that went through or a piece of flak that went through. But whatever it was, it shows you where it came in. And then it went through and out the other side. Now, whether it was a shell that didn't explode or a piece of shrapnel, we don't know. But the damage was done by the oxygen bottles, because whatever it was hit the oxygen bottles and phew, they blew. And the other oxygen bottles did the damage, because it blew from the inside, and practically all the perspex in the nose was blown out. And, of course, the bombing was still there, and the navigator not far from him. But the bombing, he got frostbite on one of his fingers because it's pretty cold at 18,000 feet, you know.
Well, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I want to hear it from you, whether it was an unexploded shell or shrapnel or whatever. But I think you do know that you weren't too far from not coming home from that mission. A few inches here or there?
I think it was a piece of shrapnel. I think if it had been a shell, it would have probably done more damage.
But if it were placed a little differently, it could have ended things for all of you.
Yeah. Like I say, the damage was done with the oxygen bottles blowing up, and blowing it from the inside.
Did your heart beat a little faster after that one?
Oh, at the time, you know, you think you're going to do, but you don't. It's amazing, I seemed more not content, you know, but I wasn't shaking like a leaf or something like that, you know, because the plane was still flying.
Yeah.
That was the main thing. The plane was still flying, and it didn't drop or anything like that. And when the skipper said, we're going on to the target, then I knew that whatever had happened, the plane was still flyable.
Were you guys all decorated for that mission?
Well, I wasn't, naturally, you know. Or the mid-upper gunner, or the radio guy, the pilot, the Navigator, the Bombardier. I think those three got the Distinguished Flying Medal.
Well, speaking of medals, I saw a few of them on your wall up there. Is there anything that, when you look at it, it gives you particular pride or satisfaction?
Of course, I got a commission, and the bombing got a commission. The pilot and the navigator were already commissioned, so that four of us were commissioned. When I finished the last mission, I was commissioned. I don't know what happened on the last mission, because when it turned out that I never got to see the pilot or any of the crew or anything like that. They just whisk you off. And they said, go get some rest, and, you know, a little bit. And then the next day when I got up, pack all your gear, you're going home. And they just whisked me off and put me on the train and off. So I never got to, that time, I never got to find out about the pilot or the rest of the crew or any of them. I didn't know where they were or what, whatever, you know. So, but later I found out that the pilot and I were the only two out the original crew that flew on the last mission. All the others were spares.
And that was 80 years ago, and you've never seen any of those other crew members again?
Never saw any one of them. Oh, the mid-upper gunner I saw. I went over on a visit. I went to see my brother. He let me use his car to drive up the coast because I learned that the mid-upper gunner was still alive up there. Uh-huh. So I found out where he lived and went up there. But I was shocked when I saw him. He had those, you know, those metal things on your arms where you have to walk.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and braces on his legs. Mm. Oh, I was in a mess and could hardly see. His wife had passed away. And not long after I got back here, I got a letter from his son to say that his dad had died.
So you saw him just in time?
I saw him just in time, yeah. And I tried to get some information out of him, and he didn't know, because he had, during our tour of operations, I know he had missed a flight. Everybody, you know, something to do with his wife. They had a baby, you know, real early, and he didn't know about the last trip either, what happened or where he was. He couldn't even think where he was. I said, well, that's a fine, how do you do, you know? And I said, I know on the last trip, I didn't know, because as soon as we got off the plane, normally they let us just wander and do what we do and take our stuff off and take your parachute back and all that kind of thing. They just rushed us around and, you know. And then we got something to eat, and that's when I found out that these guys in their clothing and that, they weren't the regular crew. I had flown with the five other guys I didn't even know.
You were back there by yourself. You had no idea.
I didn't know a damn thing, no. And when we got off on the last trip, you know, our last flight, everybody's always in a rush to get off and get to the get information. An inspection officer give him all the information. Everybody's always in a hurry to get off and get to the dining room and whatever, and then get to bed.
Well, I've got some more big picture questions for you, but one thing I read about you was that VE Day for you was pretty memorable. Do you remember where you were when you found out that Germany had surrendered and the war was over?
We was in the movie theater. I think we were in the balcony, I'm not sure. I don't know what the movie was now. They shut it down, lit it up, and someone, probably the manager, walked onto the stage and said that they had received news that the war was over. So, then the theatre emptied, and the pub doors opened.
And, you know, I've talked to a lot of American veterans about what that meant, but I'm sure for someone who had seen firsthand the damage, the destruction that the British people endured for 6 years of war, almost. What did that mean to you, to know that that was finally over?
Oh, that was marvelous, you know. I mean, you imagine these people all crowding out the theater, to hell with the theater, you know, and pub doors opened and getting in the pubs and getting a few drinks, and then some of them would get too many drinks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that because I didn't go home that night. No, I didn't. I stayed at the brother and sister.
Okay.
I stayed at their house, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the following morning I needed a shave, you know, and her father lent me his razor, you know, cutthroat.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I know. I really cut my face in several places.
And I guess I should ask you, too, since, you know, other than Pearl Harbor and the waters off the coast, the war really didn't come to the American homeland, right? But your homeland was bombarded for years. It just seems like the level of fear or anticipation that Brits had to live with during the war was different compared to Americans.
Yeah, I really didn't have much chance to mix or whatever with the civilians at all, but they seemed cheery enough, you know, unless they were in a real... In the north of England was different to what it was in the south of England, London area especially. They're the ones that got all the bombing. The north of England got some, but not like London. Liverpool got whacked, you know, a few times, and Manchester, which are on the west coast of England, they got some bombs. And then in the Midlands, they got it, you know, the Birmingham, because there was a lot of munitions building and that. And at Liverpool, because of the shipping. But at my hometown of Bradford, they said it got bombed twice, but not much. There was a movie theatre that got bombed, but everybody had just left the theatre. Then they hit the theatre. But I think it was those kind of bombing things were usually caused by when the Germans came over for some target, dropped their stuff wherever they could. And I think that's why, I think our town, because there wasn't much in our town that would bother them. But between our town and the next one, there was aircraft factory, and then there was another munitions place. And one of them was under the ground, but and of the other towns, just little bits here and there, but nothing like London.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, but also maybe your perspective on this would be helpful for us to hear. Can you give us perspective on what it meant for Great Britain when America joined the war?
Well, I think it was a damn good thing, because eventually, if they hadn't, it would have affected America, especially financially, you know. It would have affected America. Well, America had to deal with all those countries in the Far East, you know, around there, which there were more countries and, say all our countries, I guess all the different countries are connected together. You know, all the different countries in Europe were all connected together, and Germany had every one of them controlled.
World could have been a lot different. Another question that came to mind, because it was Christmas Eve when you had that hairy mission, is that something you've thought about on the Christmas Eves you've had since then?
Well, yeah, I always think some of it, because that particular time I was very friendly with a WAF. When we got hit and I got back, she was in the intelligence branch, you know, and she was always there to greet you when you got back, give you a shot of whiskey or some hot coffee or something like that to kind of tend you down.
That WAF that you were friendly with then, is that the one whose picture's on the wall here? Like a lot of retirement living facilities, the Brookdale here has a wall of honor with all the veterans' pictures. There's a lot of American veterans, but there's two Brits right in the middle, you and your wife. And it was the Royal Air Force that brought you together? What's the story there?
Oh, we met, the war was over, but I was still in the Air Force. Where our camp was, Kirkham is on the east coast of Lancashire. They had this camp It was where the Americans had been brought in. A lot of them had gone on the D-Day thing, probably from there. And they sent me there to be the officer in charge. I was there until I decided to come out. And my wife wanted to come out, but she couldn't come out until her time was up. So her time wasn't up. But if she'd have been married, she could have got out straight away. So that's what's happened. We decided to get married.
So she could get out sooner.
So she could get out sooner, yeah. She didn't have any parents. She had this older sister. The brother went into the service, so he was there no longer. So I guess my wife decided she'd join the WAFs. And so that's what she did. And she had been in 3 years.
And it seems like it worked out okay for both of you.
Yeah. The only thing is she passed away too soon. Well, she had a heart problem.
And so I've got to ask you, and I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for telling this story no one else could tell us, and thank you for helping to save the world 80 years ago. So when you look back, what would you say you're most proud of or you're most thankful for?
I was very thankful for my wife, naturally. She was a honey. She really was, yeah.
And there must be something that keeps you going. What's your secret to being in this good a shape, physically and mentally?
Just to keep going, because each day you get older, you get weaker. I've always been one that's been going, you know. I don't know, I guess it's just determination.
Ron Holdsworth, now 105 years old, and just keep going, he says. Perhaps those are relevant words for wherever you find yourself today. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.